And then there's also a schedule and a list of topics, which no guarantees, this could be slightly approximate, but just to give you an idea of what's coming, here's an approximate schedule. And then there will be, of course, the tutorials. Again, this is probably somewhat approximate topics, but gives you some idea of what we'll be presenting. And then finally, we've got a set of readings. So the papers and books that you'll find here, most of these you can find on the web for free, probably besides the Mukhanov and Winitsky book, which is also in the library downstairs. You'll definitely find this to be very helpful reading for the lectures. So the lectures will be based fairly loosely on this set of readings. And then there's also a set of optional readings, which, you know, we don't expect you to go through all of this, but if you're interested in a particular topic, you want to learn more, these are some good suggested papers and books to go look. Okay. So that's the general outline of the course. And for today, we're going to do something kind of fun. Basically, we're just going to give you a teaser of what you're going to see throughout the next 15 lectures, which Louis will present, to give you an overview of what you should expect and also to review a little bit of what you saw in the cosmology course. Okay. So with that, I'll turn it over to Louis.
All right, yes, so I'll be starting the lecture. So essentially, I'll be doing the first week and a half, and then Matt will jump in the second week. And I think also should mention that, so we're both postdocs here, and actually it works pretty good because I'm going to do the perturbative aspects of quantum field theory in cosmology, and Matt's going to do the non-perturbative. And this is actually quite closely related to our expertise here at PI, since I do a lot of quantum field theory in curved space. This is my research pretty much on this, so I think I know a little bit the subject, at the very least. And Matt here is a, you know, an expert on internal inflation and the non-perturbative aspects. So so this is how we're going to divide it. So I'll start with perturbative. Today is going to be a teaser. It's really, I essentially almost got all the concepts that we're going to see in one lecture. So it's going to be a bit like all over the place. But the goal is at the end of the class, you should hopefully be able to come back to the teaser and say, oh, I understand all this now, it's all clear. But you know, for the moment, it's just have some fun. You don't need to take notes today. We'll just start with the basic ideas and the teaser for our little class here. All right? And please interrupt if you have any questions. Is there any question on the syllabus or how the class is going to work? Okay. Right, so exploration, this is the official name of the class. We would call it putting the quantum into the cosmos. It's going to be essentially how quantum effects are actually super important in explaining the large scale of the universe today. By that, I mean like actual galaxy clusters, which are the biggest thing in the world, and somehow we need quantum physics to explain why they exist, which is pretty cool. All right, so wait a minute. Not supposed to be there. Sorry. There's two versions of the same thing open. Okay. All right. So cosmology has been having a big boom in the last 20, 30 years, and that's because it's becoming a very precise science. Before, it used to be quite a bit just almost philosophy. And it's amazing you can do science here because we only have one universe. We cannot do experiments. We cannot test our theories by simply rerunning different initial conditions and let's go to the universe, let's try it one more time. The universe has been happened once and there it is, and you just observe it and you're trying to figure out how it works. So it's not condensed matter. Condensed matter, you have an idea. Obviously you can test it. You know, you can always test an idea. There are things in cosmology and there are debates where people are always wondering, can we test this? Because we're limited in what we see. There is a finite amount of data. Fortunately for us, the universe is super big, and there's tons of it. There's tons of stuff in there. So even though it happened once, on small enough scale, so if you look at small enough objects, compared to the size of the universe, there's just so many of them that you have a lot of repetitions, like it happened many, many times, and then you just have statistics. And with these statistics, you can beat down, you know, you can do science, and you can do very precise science. And so these are some of the satellites that we've sent, Hubble, WMAP, this is ESA X-ray satellites. And with all these different ways of observing essentially always photons, we have learned quite a lot about the universe. In particular, we have this standard Big Bang. So here I'm going to review a bit, which you should have seen a bit with Leighton, but again, please ask questions if something is not clear. So there's this concordance model, or the standard Big Bang, or also known Lambda CDM. There's like three different names, roughly, which, at least to me, I'll put them all together. And what data is telling us is that we live in a nearly flat, accelerating universe, which is composed almost entirely of dark energy and dark matter. This is this, as of now, as of today. I mean, this is the state of the universe today, mostly dark energy and dark matter. We don't know what either of these two are, but we have dark matter is some good candidates, and hopefully dark matter is something we should be able to check in the next 10 years or so. But dark energy is quite still a mystery. So how does this model work? Well, we need to assume that the universe is, well, we can check that one, so it's not that big of an assumption, but we need to assume that the universe is isotropic, looks roughly the same in every direction. It's homogeneous, so it's roughly the same density everywhere. And these two things by themselves implies that the metric of the space-time universe should have this FRW form with a scale factor A of t, and which means it's a universe which is expanding but is otherwise homogeneous and isotropic. So it's not static. That's the only thing we haven't assumed here. It changed in time, but it's the same. It's homogeneous and isotropic, and the Hubble scale is this A dot over A. You should have seen that. Then this model also assumes a flat universe, and then you start in some radiation-dominated phase. So you use standard model of particle physics, and then you have to give me a cold dark matter particle, say. So here there's some model dependence, and then you have to give dark energy, which just accept that it exists, we don't really understand. But if you give these three ingredients, and you assume that the universe starts flat, then you get very well, and you also, and you also need to assume some initial perturbations. If you give me all of this, then we really can explain all the data. It's very nice. You just start with a thermal bath of radiation, then the universe cool. As the temperature drops, dark matter starts dominating at some point. So the radiation, you know, the non-relativistic dark matter start to dominate. And then at a later time, the dark energy start to dominate. And then these perturbations that you just set up as an initial condition, they grow and they lead to large-scale structure, galaxies, or perturbation in the cosmic microwave background. And this is a very nice model, lambda CDM. The lambda refers to dark energy, CDM to dark cool dark matter. And it's extremely successful. Okay, and this is essentially the standard paradigm. Okay. Again, the three ingredients very quickly. The three ingredients in this universe is dark matter and baryons. Baryons in this almost very negligible compared to dark matter. So baryons is protons, all the stuff we're made of. But the universe is mostly made of dark matter. So for example, if you look at a galaxy cluster, so this is the biggest object in the universe. This is each point is a galaxy, and they're clustered together, essentially. This is made, 5% of it is galaxies, 10% is gas, and almost all of it is dark matter. So this is a big blob of dark matter. And there are other big blocks of dark matter. So this is one of the components of the Lambda CDM model. Dark matter, it's a non-relativistic fluid, so it has zero pressure. And then when the universe is dominated by this guy, the expansion goes like t to the 2/3, and the Hubble goes like 1 over t. Okay? So this is a decelerating universe, which is always what we expect when you have gravity. If you have matter, the universe starts expanding, but because gravity wants to attract things together, the expansion should slow down. So the dark matter attracts, you know, wants to collapse. And so the universe, when it's full of this stuff, the universe wants to collapse. So it's decelerate. The expansion is slowing down. Okay. Question on this, sir? The other component is the microwave background or the radiation. This is by far the most, well, no, actually, sorry. There's the neutrino. Also, there's a cosmic neutrino background, which is very, there's a lot of them. But there's a lot of photons out there. There's much more many photons than baryons. But today, the energy of the photons is negligible compared to dark energy and dark matter. So this guy was, this is a picture by Kobe, where you see here like the dipole, the big, this is essentially the movement of the Earth through the cosmic microwave background. And then you see also the small fluctuations, which is one of the things we want to explain in this class. Okay? Temperature of this guy today is 2.73 Kelvin. It's very famous. And again, if you're in a radiation-dominated universe, then the scale factor goes like t to the 1/2. This is also decelerating. If I take a 2 derivative of this, a dot dot, this is smaller than 0. And yeah, so that's one of the components. And the last component of the universe is dark energy. Recently got a Nobel Prize for it. Was discovered in 98, big discovery. What happened is that if you look at the supernovae close by and you check the, you try to measure the distance of the supernovae, you realize that the universe is kind of, the expansion rate is going faster. This has only happened very recently, very low redshift. Redshift below 0.5. Very recently, dark energy has started to dominate. And the expansion rate now is accelerating. We're expanding faster and faster. Okay. And this is very strange. You'd think in gravity, this should not happen. And this is why if you want to have a behavior like this, you need some kind of, for example, a pressure which is negative. These kind of weird thing, anti-gravity, which of course we'll come back to. It's not that weird, but this is the basic fluid we use to do inflation with. But yeah, so when you have dark energy like this, the expansion rate, the Hubble constant becomes constant here, and then the expansion can become exponential. So it becomes super fast, and then you, and you have an accelerated universe. All right, so this is the Lambda CDM model, which you have seen. So this is very brief, obviously. And it has some problems. But first, any questions on the? You've seen this a little bit with Leighton, right? Or, yep, good. All right, so what are the problems with Lambda CDM? It's flatness, horizon, monopole, and then these are the standard tree, but I had two more, which is what's up with those initial conditions and what's up with Lambda. Right, so flatness. So the universe tends to curve. Okay, if it's flat now, it had to be even flatter in the past. So the question is why? It's just weird, you know. It's just a strange initial condition. It's one, if you look at it, it's like putting a pen on the tip. It's just not stable. So if it's flat today, it had to be even flatter in the past, and so it begs for an explanation, obviously. The other one, I'm not going in order here, is the monopole problem. And the question there is, why did the universe start with radiation and not with matter? Because if you start with radiation then and you wait, as it cools down, matter will dominate. So why did we not start directly with matter? Why? And there's many theories which predicts, for example, massive monopoles. And if these theories are right, then the universe should have started with those massive monopoles, and massive monopoles should have dominated the energy density. And if that would have happened, you would never had us. You know, recombination, all the physics, BBN would not have happened. We would have a universe filled with monopoles, which would be nice, but not quite what we see, obviously. So that's one problem. The other problem, the cosmological constant problem. What's up with lambda? As we'll see at the end, we may come back a bit to how inflation may actually provide some kind of answer for this, but come back. This is a big question today, and you know we don't know the answer of this question yet. So, but let's talk about these two, horizon and initial condition. So let's look at the cosmic microwave background. So the radiation release, so what is this? So what happened is that we have a universe at first which is a big plasma, very hot plasma made of protons and electrons. And because the temperature is hot at the beginning, when close to Big Bang, these things are ionized. Okay? So the photons can't travel anywhere because you know, this is a ionized plasma and anthrax with all the stuff. This is charged particle here, charged protons and charged electrons. As the universe cools down, at some point, there is recombination, which is really badly named. It's really the first time the universe combined. And so what happens is the hydrogen and the protons and the electrons combined to form neutral hydrogen. And then the universe became transparent. Okay. At that point, so we call this surface here the surface of last scattering. The last time, essentially, roughly, that the photons scattered or something. From there, they're just free streaming directly to us. Okay. Imagine the other photons are moving. Imagine this is a little Penrose diagram like you will look at today in the tutorial. So the light rays are traveling on 45 degree lines, okay, coming to us. And so when we see the CMB, the cosmic microwave background, we're seeing the surface of that scattering. which today is in microwave because of the expanding universe, so the wavelength has been stretched. Okay. All right. So what's the horizon problem? This is a review. Again, you should have probably seen this with Leighton a bit. But the idea is when I take WMAP and I look at this microwave background, and I look at two points opposite on the sky, and I just draw, you know, let's say the Big Bang is here, then these two guys here should not have been in causal contact. Okay, they should. There's no way these guys can have touch in the standard Big Bang picture. They don't have. There's no way they can have ever been in any exchange of information between two. This requires faster than light travel. Okay, and yet when we look at the CMB, we see that these two points have exactly the same temperature. So this is the horizon problem. How do you explain that these two guys here have roughly exactly the same temperature, how do you explain that the universe is very homogeneous on large scale? Okay, and this is where inflation comes in. So inflation, the idea is we have an era of accelerated expansion. So take this is the A dot, so the derivative of the scale factor is a function of time. So a standard in the lambda CDM model, it's just decelerating universe. You're radiation dominated, so it goes down. You're slowing down your expansion until dark energy dominates, and then we go back up. But this is a very small, this is like very recent and very small accelerated phase. The idea of inflation is to assume that there's this dark energy, but you know, on steroids. Just put it right here at the beginning, put dark energy right at the beginning, and let it go real fast. So you put at very high scale dark energy, and then the universe goes into this accelerated phase where it becomes very huge, very fast. Okay? As long as inflation lasts long enough, you can make everything that we see today in causal contact back in the past, and you can explain why the universe is homogeneous. Yes?
Does that mean after that time, let's wait another, some million or billion years, we would see that it's not that homogeneous?
It could be. That's very
At least that is something that model would allow.
That's right. So you could have just enough inflation, the minimal amount of inflation, in order to explain that what the largest scale we see today are homogeneous or had been, you know. But it could be that if you wait, indeed, at some point we see stuff which is not homogeneous.
So is there a way to explain that the whole universe is really completely homogeneous, coming, let's say, from a point expanding really completely homogeneous to something infinite?
Well, I guess, there's a different level to that question, I think. The observable universe is really, you can always explain why the whole observable universe is homogeneous, because that just requires a certain finite amount of inflation. But when we get into the business of eternal inflation, then you can say, well, since I have inflation going forever, then everything should have been, you know, flattened, or everything should be in causal contact. But, and that's true, but there's more to this also, because as we'll learn, eternal inflation predicts a very actual inhomogeneous universe on a very, very large scale, because there's these bubbles and all sort of stuff. So I'm going on here. It's a good question. We'll come back to this. But essentially, there's a minimum number of inflation we need to explain why the universe is flat and why the things are in causal contact. We call this usually, it's like the 60 e-folds, which really depends on your theory. It could be a little bit more. But there's the number of e-folds of inflation that you need. So number of times the universe expanded by a factor of e. And so you need a certain minimum of those in order to explain why the large scale today is in causal contact. If you have more than, which usually many theories have, if you have more than, a lot more of the universe would be homogeneous. Okay? Right, so inflation takes a little patch here, then creates a huge universe. By doing so, it also makes it flat, because even if you start with a curved space, it becomes very, very flat as you know, as you expand like this. Okay, so that's the basic idea. The standard model to do inflation with is called the slow inflation. I'll just give you this quick picture. We'll come back to this in class. The idea is you can get, there's an easy way, relatively easy way to get this negative pressure fluid. And the idea is you just take a scalar field, classical scalar field here, just with some potential V of phi, and you imagine to be in a phase where you're slowly rolling, that is the kinetic energy is subdominant compared to the potential energy. So this is the density, this is T00, the stress unit tensor, and this is TII. So this is the pressure, And the idea is this is kinetic energy plus V, kinetic energy minus V. And so if you're in a region where this is negligible, then you have rho equal minus V. You have negative pressure, effectively a negative pressure. Then if you do that and you just look at the equation, the Friedmann equation, you get that the elbow constant is roughly constant, which is always a bit weird. H is constant, and the scale factor is growing exponentially. Okay? And this is a very simple model of inflation, and it will solve the horizon problem. And this is why inflation was invented back, to solve these three problems, really. Where inflation really shines, and where everybody loves it, is when it gets to here. What's happening with those initial conditions? And this is the most amazing part, I think, of the story. So our universe is not homogeneous. Obviously, you exist. There's a galaxy, you know, there's planets. There are a lot of structure. The level of structure that we see is about 10 to the minus 5 to start with. This is the CMB here. We see temperature fluctuation of order 1 in 10,000. We also look here. This is a plot of SDSS, which plots each point as a galaxy. So you look in the sky and just put all the galaxies as a function of distances, and you can see it's not quite homogeneous. It looks homogeneous roughly on large scales, but it's not quite. And the fluctuations are, again, about 10 to the minus 5. They grow. If you go on small scale, they tend to be much bigger because gravity starts growing. Obviously, when you have a black hole, the density contrast is much more than 10 to the minus 5. But roughly, this is the numbers that we have in our universe. So in lambda CDM, in order to explain that, in order to explain that we have this structure, in lambda CDM, you need to assume initial conditions. There's no way to create those. So you just need to assume them. If the universe started homogeneous, nothing would happen. It would stay homogeneous. So we have to give it some kick in order for galaxies to form. Okay. So here's an example. So this is a box of cold, dark matter. Each point here is a particle, say a wimp. A massive particle of dark matter. These guys only interact through gravity. Okay? So only Newton, actually, for most of structure formation, you can use Newton's theory. You don't even need GR. So just Newton's law. These guys attract Newton's law. And so if it was homogeneous, nothing would happen. But what we need to do is we need to put some perturbations in there. So here there are some perturbations. You can't see them. They're at the level of 1 in 10,000. Okay, but there are some perturbations. Then you let it go. And here's what natural gravity, Newton's law, nothing magic here, just Newton's law in an expanding universe, this is what it creates. And z is redshift here, so you look, z0 is today, higher redshift. So you don't need, it's to get the basic form of the large-scale structure, it looks very simple, right? You just put some perturbations and you get this. Now, of course, these perturbations were very special. If I just put some random perturbation, I won't get this picture. So where do these perturbations come from is really the question. And these perturbations that we see in the galaxies in the CMB have the following three basic properties, which are weird, but as we like to explain in this class, this is what inflation explains naturally. First thing is they're Gaussian. Okay, so these are random perturbations which are drawn from a Gaussian, okay, with some variance, over order 10 to minus 5, obviously. All right, anyway. So they're nearly scale invariant. That means there's the same power on each scale. So their perturbations are 1 meter long, and their perturbations which are 1 megaparsec long. And the idea is they would be the same power on each of the same amount, the same size perturbation on each of these very different scales. And then the third one is a bit more mysterious here, but they're frozen on super horizon scale. That is, they've been pre-established. They've been laid down, like there. Let me show you here clearer. So here are, try to explain a bit more these properties. The idea is that imagine I have space-time. It's FRW with a scale factor. But I'm going to put some perturbations, some bumps in the space-time. So this can be seen as a gravitational potential in Newton's theory. So I'm just putting some bumps in the space-time itself. I'm putting perturbations on all wavelength. So if I would the power here, k is a wave number, which we usually write here as a h is. This is a one over megaparsec. Okay, so megaparsec. The parsec is the unit. Everybody knows the parsec. I won't use it that much, but yeah. So parsec is the distance at which a star, the parallax of a star, is 1 arcsecond. So it's the unit we use in astrophysics. Megaparsec is a standard size of the object in the universe, pretty much. Biggest objects like 20 megaparsec. A galaxy is like in kiloparsec. So just to give you a range. So a galaxy is in kiloparsec, galaxy clusters are in megaparsec, and the universe is like maybe 100 or 1,000 megaparsec, something. So, you know, megaparsec is kind of a good number to remember when you talk about the universe. All right, and so we have power spectrum for it, and what we find is that there's the same power, it doesn't matter what the number is here, this is just not to scale, but the point is there's the same power on every scale. We see perturbation on every wavelength with the same power. These guys are drawn from a Gaussian, and the idea is they've been created by somebody, say inflation, and they've been like, they're imprinted on the space-time. They're just there. Okay, they're frozen, they just exist out there. And then what happens in our universe, as we expand, we just discover them. They've already been created, and our universe expands, and then first the universe is kind of small. This is not a perturbation, this looks like flat. Here, these guys, all the dark matter is like on this side of the universe, realize, hey, we should go to the left. You know, this is a universe-sized perturbation. Everybody want to go to one side of the universe. This is a, weirder. But the universe expands, we see more and more of these perturbations. And they've all been sort of already created. So we just, they sort of re-enter the horizon, and then when we say that, the language we say is that these perturbations re-enter the horizon, and then we follow it. So if you give me these perturbations, lambda CDM works properly. It just, you can pretty much explain all the structure. But of course, it's a very weird set of initial perturbations, and so what's great about inflation is it naturally gives you those perturbations. And what's even more amazing is it gives you those perturbations from quantum physics. Okay. So quantum fluctuation, for example, of the scalar fields here, naturally, through inflation, these quantum fluctuations are amplified, and they naturally generate all the structure that we see today. So this is a statement that quantum fluctuation generates temperature fluctuation in the microwave background, and also generates the galaxy clusters and the galaxies. This is the seed for all the structure in the universe. So obviously, some of us think this is pretty cool. and the idea of this class will be to study this process. How do we generate this quantum fluctuation? Why are they so big? And what's their properties? And let me give you a bit more picture of this. Any questions? Or? Yes?
What do you mean by quantum fluctuation scale?
So normally, essentially, this scalar field phi here, it cannot, in quantum mechanics, it cannot really ever have phi an exact value, right? It always needs to fluctuate with some quantum fluctuation. In normal flat space, these quantum fluctuations are very small. They're order h bar. And they're very small fluctuation. But the idea is if you look at a fundamental scalar field, it's continuously fluctuating. What happens is that when you're in an inflating universe, when you're in a phase of accelerated expansion, these fluctuations actually grow. And they freeze, and they become exactly the kind of fluctuations that we need for this model. This is exactly, this is going to be my part of the story in this class, is to explain this. So in fact, you can see that first, before we actually understand this, the first part of this week, these lectures, will be to explain what we mean by quantum field theory in curved space. Why is it behaving differently? Because you don't expect quantum fluctuation to create galaxies, in this room. The quantum fluctuations here are very negligible. But the idea is that in this kind of curved spaceline, you get very different behavior from these quantum fluctuations. They become much more important. Yes?
So do you perform kind of measurement that these quantum fluctuations in the state become available, that you can really see
the quantum nature?
Yeah.
No, very good question. They look like, but the thing is that they become classical at some point. So they start quantum fluctuation, but then they start behaving classically in the sense that they are very high occupation number for the state.
But don't you need a measurement for that? I mean, if you say the system is in a wave function state, then the quantum fluctuation should only arise when you have something like measure.
Yes, well, you could think when we measure the fluctuation in the microwave background, essentially, that's when we do the measurement or stuff. But this question is very tricky, because what do you mean by measuring fluctuations for the whole universe when, say, we live in it? So it's a fair question. How do you do the decoherence and all this stuff for this classical? The point is that even if you were not actually performing the measurement and decoherating the states and everything, the expansion already puts it in a classical state in the sense that I have really high fluctuation number. So the question is whether you could tell whether you collapse the state or whatever you like to call it. You know, that I don't know, but it looks like it's impossible. It's very hard to the perturbations look completely classical when they create this map here. Okay, they behave like classical perturbations. So it would be very hard experimentally to tell that they were truly quantum. So the point is that if you believe inflation, then that's where they come from. They come from quantum fluctuations. But we're not really truly seeing the quantum nature of these fluctuations. They look classical to us.
Okay, but in that model, we can explain that, and it makes sense.
The inflation naturally explains why they should look classical.
Okay.
Right. They come quantum. They start quantum, but they behave very classically when we come time to see them in our universe. Just think, they become huge, and so they behave like classical objects, the huge waves. All right. So in fact, here's a picture. Okay. So imagine you have an accelerating phase with a nearly constant bubble. So h is nearly constant, which means the horizon is 1 over the Hubble constant. This is sort of the observable. This is as far as we can see in our universe. It's the observable universe. So it's roughly 1 over h. And it's constant during this inflation phase. Then we have perturbations, same as scalar field. And this is a result which I like to explain in the class. But at the moment, just think of it that roughly what happened is that you get a fluctuation for each mode k, each wave number k. And these are essentially constant, and the constant is set by this bubble. So you get a fluctuation whose amplitude is of this order. Okay. I'll review tomorrow why the flat space story, which is obviously totally not, probably definite, but this is the inflation story, which we'll learn later in this class. Right, so you get these fluctuations of order h on this bubble-sized object, and what happens is the universe is accelerating, huge expansion. So everything gets stretched. The universe gets really big, and each of these perturbations gets very large wavelength, huge wavelength. So you have a 1 meter fluctuation here, but the universe expands and then becomes really quickly super, super big. The horizon itself is not changing, because h is roughly constant in this space. So if I'm an observer, what I see is I see everything going away from me, and I just lose like all the information. This is what's happening right now, in fact. Because our universe is dark energy dominated, the stuff is going away from us, and unless something's changed, it looks like the future is going to be pretty deserted, because everything is going away, and we won't see it. Right, so and then what happened, and this is going to be, again, the subject of a lecture, is that these fluctuations in the scalar field give rise to curvature fluctuation. So fluctuation in the curvature of spacetime. These are these bumps and bubbles. Okay. And then inflation ends. And then when inflation ends, we enter the usual decelerating phase of expansion. In the decelerating phase of expansion, the Hubble constant is dropping. It goes 1 over time. This is true for both radiation and matter. So as time goes forward, this guy decreases. If this guy decreases, it means that the horizon is increasing. So as the horizon increases, our observable universe, our horizon, catches up with those perturbations. So when the horizon increases, now we rediscover all these fluctuations which were created back during inflation. Okay. And when we rediscover them, then we suddenly realize that, wait a minute, there's a curvature perturbation,
over there. I have a dark matter particle. Let me go over there, because that's what you're, you know, GR tells me I should follow the space-time. So there's a curvature. So then all the universe collapse, and then when the dark matter, and then they self-interact also. I mean, this is a nonlinear process at some point. And the point is the dark matter falls in an initial perturbation, but as more dark matter falls in, it attracts more and more, and you get galaxies, and so the perturbation grows naturally. With the radiation, it's a little bit more tricky, because the radiation has pressure, so it falls in, but it bounces back, and then you get all these nice acoustic peaks and CMB. So there's a lot more physics going on. But the idea is they fall in still, and they interact, and they do give you some nice structure. Any question? Again? This is the very basic picture of how inflation gives us these initial conditions. Right, and then this curvature perturbation, I already said. There's a map here, and we won't do very much of that. This is like, this would be a class on its own, and we only have 3 weeks, so we won't do that much. But I'll still want to give you a little bit of the flavor. We want to give you a little bit of the flavor on how to transform the curvature into temperature fluctuations and density perturbation. Well, I won't really do density, but I'll just do the temperature, at least on large scale. So temperature fluctuation in the CMB. So I'll do these original perturbation gives rise to those. Okay, great. So inflation. So this is roughly the first part of the class, is to just give you inflation, do the perturbative aspects. But there's a lot more. And so once you, and so this is where math will come in, and this is the sort of gets to really deep and part and fun part of inflation, is it implies a lot of things. So first of all, it implies this regime of eternal inflation that I'll describe in a minute. And so it essentially is the idea that inflation might not be ending everywhere. It might be part of the universe which are continuously inflating. They never end. Then there's a couple of questions also like this. How do you really start inflation? Whenever you, and this is, we're doomed with like that in cosmology, whenever you find a new beginning, then you have to ask about the previous beginnings, right? So now we have like standard Big Bang. Now we say, now there's inflation before that, but now where does inflation come from? So we have to ask the question, and we have to try to answer it. Is there any alternatives to inflation? Is there any other way you can get a flat universe, solve the horizon problem, or generate perturbation? How are we faring, actually, in testing inflation? This is the kind of question we want to ask. It's hard to test, but hopefully we can test it. And if maybe there are alternatives, maybe you can compare inflation to other models and just try to judge which one is being more successful at expanding the universe. So these are the kind of questions we want to ask and try to answer in the second part of the class, right? In particular, this concept of eternal inflation is pretty cool. So let me just give you a small teaser about that. So stochastic eternal inflation is maybe the simplest type. It's the idea that, well, I have these quantum fluctuations. They're of order h over 2 pi. Say. So these are like huge quantum perturbations. But this guy is rolling down very slowly its potential. Now, it turns out that you can arrange things such that the quantum fluctuations are about the same size as the classical motion. That is the quantum. So this is like, this is saying that the field is fluctuating of order h over distances 1 over h and time 1 over h. So delta x here. So h is energy, so distances is 1 over energy, so 1 over h, and time, again, the same thing, 1 over h. Over these distances and over this time, I have fluctuation of order Hubble. Okay, so there's a one scale in the problem, really. And the idea is that, so I have this quantum fluctuation, and during that time and over these distances, the field has maybe dropped down a little bit by some amount, which usually just be by the speed and h. So what happens is there's a regime where the quantum perturbation is as big as the classical. So that means that on average, you never go anywhere. The quantum fluctuation makes you jigger, and you just never go, and you know, you just stay there. This is really amazing, because this means that, first of all, there are places in the universe which never stops. It just always stays there. There are some places where the energy actually goes up. You just go higher on the potential. There are some places where inflation ends, and you go down. And so you get a very intricate picture, and you get a very quantum geometry, because some part of the universe are inflating, some parts are not. So the whole structure, global structure of space-time,
is determined by these quantum fluctuations. So it's a very quantum, you know, universe. It's super huge because they're essentially it's infinite, right? Because they are parts which always inflate. So it's just they grow exponentially and they never stop. They just inflate and they become. So it's an infinite universe, and yeah, it's just bewildering. So part of the class will be to study this quite amazing structure. Another type of internal inflation is this tunneling, and this is related to vacuum decay. So the idea is that I could be in a false vacuum, and then if I'm in session, this is actually the original model of inflation as proposed by Alan Goop back in the 80s. And the problem, the reason why his model didn't work, the first model we proposed, is because his model did not end, which is the point here. When you have a model like this, you have eternal inflation, and inflation does not end. But it can end at look at small places. You know, it can end locally. There are observers for which inflation ends, but there are observers for which inflation just never ends. Okay. So anyway, so you're in this false vacuum, then just as in quantum mechanics, you can tunnel, and you can go to another vacuum here and another vacuum here, and so then we could be living here. So this would be inflating because it has high vacuum energy. So this is like dark energy here. So this is inflating. But then suddenly you tunnel, and then you end up in a, say, today's universe, and inflation ends. Okay. So and this is another way you get eternal inflation, this false vacuum decay. So part of this class will be to teach you this is non-perturbative quantum field theory in Curie space, because this is a tunneling event. This is what Matt here would talk about more. All you do this vacuum decay business, and again it leads to this eternal inflation. Wow, I think I'm doing good on time. All right, so here's a picture of this. So the idea is the universe is inflating forever, and sometimes in some bubbles the universe, you know, inflation ends, and so you get these bubbles of universe where inflation has ended. But everywhere the universe just keeps inflating. So it's an infinite size universe with an infinite number of bubbles, each of which could be another universe. So you get this multiverse picture. Which is the natural consequence of really inflation. You don't need to assume very much. Okay? And so one of the proposals, right, we don't really know if this is true, but one of the proposals is that we could just be living in one of those bubbles. Okay? I don't know which one. I think which one looks good. Anyway.
Painfully long, doesn't it?
Yeah, this one. Et voilà, we live in this. So it's a very amazing picture, if it's true. It's hard. You can ask, can we ever verify this? But it's interesting that you take inflation, which almost every cosmologist just loves it, or at least they think there should be some alternative which are close to inflation. But you take inflation, you don't need to assume very much more, and you get these crazy pictures where you have multiverses, tons of bubbles, and all sort of things going on, and it's very. You know, you have a theory, you have to work out the consequences of that theory. And inflation naturally leads to this picture. So we'll discuss that later in this class and try to explain this. All right, I think I'm going good on time. And let me conclude this little teaser here with vacuum decay. So vacuum decay is something that you need for eternal inflation, but it's also something that just could happen, like in this room. So one of the papers that I recommend to read that's on the syllabus is this paper by Coleman and Frank DeLucia. And this is a very great paper. And this is a quote and their conclusion. And if you write a paper in physics and you get to finish your conclusion like this, this is awesome. So, I mean, Coleman is always very funny, but this is a particularly good one. So let me read this. So the possibility that we're living in a false vacuum has never been a cheering one to contemplate. Vacuum decay is the ultimate ecological catastrophe. In a new vacuum, there are new constants of nature. After vacuum decay, not only is life as we know it impossible, so is chemistry as we know it. However, one could always draw stoic comfort from the possibility that perhaps, in the course of time, the new vacuum will sustain, if not life as we know it, at least some structures capable of knowing joy. This possibility has now been eliminated. So let me put this in context. These guys showed in their paper that flat space cannot decay, or if it does, it decays to something called, it decays to ADS, so it decays to a negative cosmological constant, and they showed that this was unstable. And so that's why at the end, he says, well, even this very stoic, comforting idea that there could be some structure out there has been ruled out because they showed that when you tunnel to ADS, it collapses into a singularity, something that is nice in this paper. I'm not sure if we're going to really discuss that much, that idea. But anyway, so so that's pretty funny. But actually, it turns out also it's a bit wrong now because these guys didn't know that we now have a dark energy. So we're not living in a flat space. We're not living in Minkowski spacetime. We're living with a positive Kustrow constant. So it's very possible now, actually, that we could decay not to a negative Kustrow constant, but just to a lower dark energy than we already have. So it could be that in the future, the universe will suddenly decay to something. And indeed, that would be the worst possible ecological catastrophe if that was to happen. Although it's an interesting problem to imagine whether we could feel that decay or whether it would create baby universes also, things that you can have fun with. All right, so I went a bit actually fast, I think. But so any questions on this vacuum decay business? So for the rest of this class, let me give you a bit again the basic plan. So tomorrow I'll review quantum field theory and curves, well, just basic quantum field theory that we will need for this class, and a little bit in curve space. Essentially, the basic notion, which I'm not sure how much you've been playing with this, but it's the notion of particle and the notion of vacuum. What does it mean to define a vacuum in a quantum field theory, and what is the notion of a particle? Turns out the notion of particle is observer dependent. Okay, so it's really not a good GR notion, if you want. It's if different observers on different geodesics will naturally detect different number of particles. So we have to be careful about that when we do quantum field theory in curved space. This is one of the basic thing, and we'll do the unruh effect, which you may have heard about. So if you're accelerating something, you get particle production. Seems like something, there's particle production going on. Okay. So that's one of the things I'll be discussing. And then I'll discuss FRW and then the Sutter space, which are example of curved spacetime, which are relevant for cosmology, obviously. And then we'll do this inflation business. So that's the plan for the first week and a half. And then after that, we'll get into the stochastic eternal inflation and the vacuum decay in quantum field theory. We'll look at this marvelous paper of Coleman and Lucia and all these kinds of things. So, I'll just end here for today and then start again tomorrow. Okay, thanks.